As we cultivate this meditation on loving kindness, there's to say it, a variety of formulations that can be used, and you know, some of them can be complicated, some of them can be quite simple. But I think what is most important is to recognize how it works, how it affects one, in that what is it that feels, resonates and helps to bring into being a feeling of loving kindness, a perception of loving kindness, of a sense of friendliness, a quality of interest in the well-being or wish for well-being of oneself and others. And in using it as a meditation, the use of words and phrases are helpful ways of establishing a mindfulness or a recollection, just using a phrase and then planting that seed within the heart, within the mind, and then that, because the nature of the mind, of course, is to think, proliferate, come up with different thoughts and phrases, and to stories. This is usually not just short little sentences here and there. It's just, you know, full blown stories. helping to keep the mind on track is how one uses those phrases and sort of, okay, right, I'm doing loving kindness meditation, and that so that using those phrases, whether from the Buddha's discourse on loving kindness, that sense, wishing and gladness and safety, may all beings be at ease, or the, you know, may I be well, happy, peaceful, those are ways to keep the mind on track and reminding it what it's actually intended to do. So that is a meditation. That is how we train the mind. And the, even if one just wants to use the word metta, it's like in Thailand, one of the most common meditation methods or techniques is to just using the word Buddho, the name of the Buddha. On the in-breath, Buddha, on the out-breath, Tho. And that's just using that simple word. Well, you can use metta. On the in-breath, metta, on the out-breath, metta, metta. So they're just using that word to, okay, keeping the mind on track, tuning into the feeling, connotations of metta that one has reflected on, and helping the mind to channel its attention and energy to that which is has an emotional tone of well-wishing and has a say has a pleasing tone to it. As in meditation, the metta meditations have a very useful function of providing a sense of kind of like emotional moisture, in the sense of you think of anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta. It gets pretty dry after a while. The impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. Impermanence, unsatisfactory, not self. Anything, and it's all, it's true, but say the mind actually has to be prepared, balanced in ways so that the metta bhavana can be a very useful basis for providing a sense of kind of moisture, warmth, a sense of a brightness to the mind. I mean, the opposite is true as well, in the sense of if one really sees impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self, one of the kind of the sure indications that the insight is actually a true insight is this sense of universal kindness and well-wishing. It's sort of like, wow, just everything is in the same boat. Wow. And there's a sense of care. It's a natural, the heart's natural response to a deep insight. Because but usually we don't start with deep insights. It's good to sprinkle that a bit and to lubricate the insights, and lubricate the heart, so that it's ready or it's ripe. It's able to respond. And also in practice, as we continue in a particular spiritual practice, then it is quite natural that one does become, say, inured or accustomed to the particular pattern of reflection, investigation, practice that one is doing, so that having supportive practices that one is doing help one to have it creates a broad base for one's practice and one's insight to continue to so that one has the sort of the energy for practice. Today I'd like to introduce as a meditation, it's a chant that is labeled Reflections on Universal Well-Being, which are actually a Brahmavihara, say all four Brahmaviharas, but the almost a half of it is specifically about metta, loving kindness. And I think that that's quite rightly appropriate, in that it's really the doorway into the other Brahmaviharas. The the loving kindness, the metta, is as one is able to establish that that wish for well-being, then it it does it lay the foundation, lay the base for the quality of compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, and I think just to try to establish equanimity or sympathetic joy on its own is not that easy, but the loving kindness is an appropriate doorway into those sublime abidings. And the the chant begins with a very direct statement of in Pali it's Ahang Sukhito Homi, which is may I be happy, and of course if you're chanting that it falls a bit flat, you know, you start may I be happy, and then it's kind of fun. Whereas you begin a chant, may I abide in well-being, I mean, it's kind of nice, you know, to chant. Whereas, you know, so, may I, it's so that, you know, yeah, well, may I be happy is a very precise translation of that Ahang Sukhito Homi, but I think they've taken a bit of poetic license in order to make it a bit more chantable, and for myself, having chanted this for decades now, that it that's what comes to mind when I think of that, and then when I use it as a meditation, then it comes out as a chant. It's hard for me to just sort of say it, and it's a very beautiful chant. Establishing that wish: may I abide in well-being, may I abide in happiness, may I abide in the basis of you know, all that is pleasurable and delightful. That wish that one directs attention to oneself, and that is very much the classical mode of cultivation of loving kindness is really to direct attention to oneself, and to establish that very strong feeling of well-wishing towards oneself. There's in the scriptures there's a very lovely exchange that it was between King Pasenadi and Queen Malika, he was the king of Kosala, which is where Savati was, and that's where the Buddha spent in the Jetavana Grove and other places in the area of Savati. He spent the majority of his, I think he was 27 years as a residence in Savati and in Rain's residences in Savati. So he was very familiar with King Pasenadi, and Queen Malika is somebody who was a devout Buddhist, had a solid practice. I think she was a stream enterer. King Pasenadi, there is no mention of him having. He had tremendous faith in the Buddha, but there's never any mention of him having attained any levels of liberation. And anyway, they're in the palace King Pasenadi, sort of husband and wife talk, you know, who is it that you cherish the most? Queen Malika says, well, I cherish myself the most. he always takes her lead. I mean, she's really he has both tremendous love and respect for her. So he said, well, must be something to this. He goes to the Buddha and recounts the conversation, and the Buddha says, well, that's exactly, that's how it should be, and that is actually how it is in reality. And it's when we really cherish ourselves fully, honor ourselves fully, that's when we can really look after and cherish others. Yes, we really need to have that foundation. It isn't a sort of a selfish obsession with me, but it's a, in reality, we do need to cherish ourselves, and we have to, you know, when if I eat something and nobody else gets full, so we relate to ourselves for it just on a cellular level, so that on an emotional level we need to attend to ourselves in ways that are appropriate and skillful. And when we do that, when we look after ourselves and really attend to our well-being, that's when we can be a refuge for others and be somebody who is really there for others. Because we're, as human beings, we're not all that different. Despite all our fascinating uniquenesses. we're not really very different. so that when we really tune in and understand ourselves, then we can really be present for others. And it's our unskillful obsession with ourselves that actually blocks us off from others. So that establishing that sense of, you know, may I abide in well-being, really taking that in and opening the heart to that wish, that really sincere wish, may I abide in well-being, in freedom from affliction. And it's in Pali, it's nidukho homi, so that without dukkha, without suffering, in freedom from hostility, aware o homi, which is aware when where is like conflict. And also grudges. When we get caught in grudges or conflicts that sort of bind us together, in Thai, there's a there's a word, and it's almost like an idiom that you say when something goes wrong. Sort of, you say, in English, shoot. In Thai, you sort of say, wain gum. So it's like, this conflict and karma. And so then, that establishing that wish, may I abide in freedom from hostility, and in freedom from any kind of conflict. Abhiya pacho homi, and freedom from ill will. Payabhat is the ill will, anger, irritation, aversion. So that may I abide in freedom from ill will. Aniko homi, in freedom from anxiety. Just that anxiety, worry, fear. Just establishing that wish. May I abide in freedom from anxiety. And then sukhiyatanam pariharami. Atta, sort of the me, self. Atta, sukhi, atanam. May myself be happy. May it be established in happiness. And may I maintain well-being in myself. So that drawing attention into that wish well-being, freedom from affliction, freedom from hostility, freedom from ill will, freedom from anxiety, and that wish to maintain well-being, to establish oneself grounded in well-being. And as one develops that as a meditation, just going through those phrases, and one can repeat that many, many times until it feels like it's solid, and one feels grounded in that wish for that well-wishing toward oneself, then to allow it to be a bit more non-directional, not directed toward oneself, but a bit more pervasive. May everyone abide in well-being. In the Pali, it's sambhesata, may all beings abide in well-being. May all beings be happy. Mm-hmm. And those similar recollections or aspirations, may all beings, sambhesata vela huntu, may all beings abide in freedom from hostility. And may all beings, may everyone abide in freedom from ill will. May all beings abide in freedom from anxiety. Those feelings of fear, worry, anxiety, that's part of the not just the human condition, the actual condition of having a life force, whether it's a human being or a mammal or an insect. Since as soon as you have a life force, then you're protecting it. It's like every being wants to get away from pain or any kind of threat to themselves. So then there's a fear that, of course, that there is going to be some threat. And that's like living in the forest. The animals, they're they're constantly attuned to danger. It's like you see that in, say, Abayagiri, which is a big forest, and it lots of animals there, and they're it's like the deer. They don't have any physical means of, or clear physical means of aggression, but they got big ears, and they're listening. They're anxious. They're keeping they got big eyes. They're keeping their eyes. They're on the lookout for anything that might be a bit threatening. As their ears are constantly scanning, and there's anxiety there. And sort of that's the nature of being born into a physical body, is that you're vulnerable. We can obsess on things like that, and then keep spinning ourselves out with anxiety. It's like the there's a book by a scientist named Robert Sapolsky. It was why zebras don't get ulcers. And it's they're geared to, if there's danger, a lion attacks, they're out of there as quick as they can. They might even be mauled or see a friend mauled, but as soon as that is over, they're out there grazing, and human beings, on the other hand, are constantly planning about the next perceived threat, which may or may not happen. So, and we end up with ulcers. So a response that serves one well in certain circumstances, when it's applied across the board, doesn't serve us well. So that dwelling in anxiety is exceedingly uncomfortable. That sheet of paper that I passed out, sharing of loving kindness, and that has a very, very similar formulation, a bit of a twist, which is very nice, but it uses those same structures of, and this is actually the classical mold. This is out of a very early commentarial treatise called the Patisampita Magga. It's so old that it's in the Pali Canon. And these are the formulation for one of their ways of cultivation of loving kindness, so that developing the avera, which is freedom from hostility, abhyampaja, freedom from ill will, freedom from anxiety, and then that wish for happiness. So that as one cultivates these feeling, this recitation and recollection, cultivating the feeling in the sense that, you know, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. And just as I wish to be well, happy, and peaceful, may all beings be well, happy, and peaceful. That wish is not just isolated or focused solely on oneself, but it's in the same way that I wish to be well, happy, and peaceful. May all beings experience that. And may I be free from animosity. As I wish to be free from animosity, may all beings. And may I be free from any kind of suffering. And as I wish to. So those are, may I live in peace and happiness. As I wish to live in peace and happiness, may all beings live in peace and happiness. So those are, you know, helpful phrases that are structures, and sometimes it's helpful just to get knowledgeable about the Pali, the scriptural language, because sometimes our own English language has we have a whole backlog of associations and sort of habit patterns of thought or reaction, and then be able to see because particularly for the Pali language, and not just about these phrases, but as one delves into Buddhism, the only function that the Pali language has performed over the last 2,300 years or something is to maintain the discourses of the Buddha, so that it's a technical language, and the Buddha probably spoke a language very similar to that. There's always controversy as exactly how the but there's a Pali is a sort of a mid-Indian ancient dialect, and the scriptures were written down in that, and so that the even if it wasn't maybe exactly what the Buddha spoke at that time, it's very, very close, and its only function has been to pass on the words of the Buddha, the scriptures, and the teachings, so that it's a technical language that is geared to spiritual themes. So as we've been mentioning these last, I've been mentioning the last couple of days, I say just like kusala and akusala, that is it's a technical term that points to a particular state of mind that is wholesome, beneficial, skillful, or its opposite, and then it has particular parameters, like tanha. It's a specific desire that is rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion, and a non-recognition of the way things truly are. But when the Buddha says tanha is the source of suffering, he's not saying desire as a generic term is the source of suffering. It's a specific form of desire, so that it's helpful to sometimes as an exercise to familiarize oneself with some of the the basic terms, and then things start to leap out at one. As we cultivate consciously the quality of loving kindness, again, this is something that doesn't, we bring attention to, may I abide in well-being, and really trying to establish that wish very firmly and very clearly towards oneself within the heart. But it doesn't, say, it just doesn't affect oneself. It transforms oneself, and by transforming oneself, it has an effect on the world around one, the people. Just by, having a week of loving kindness, practice and training, it's just going back home, going back to one's workplace, take note of what is there any change, anything different. Or do you get, somebody says, well, you've come back from a week of loving kindness? There's a story in the, I think it's in the Visuddhimagga, it's a commentarial treatise, and where the story is about a person from a man from India who hears about Sri Lanka, and there's lots of people who are practicing, and Buddhism is flourishing, because this is in a time of almost 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away. So there's big changes happening in India at that time. So then Sri Lanka is flourishing at that time in terms of Buddhism, and he has the intention to take ordination. So he gives up his business and takes leave of his family and travels to Sri Lanka, takes ordination, and he's interested in sort of the loving kindness meditation. So he gets instruction, and then he goes to live in a place where there's many meditators living there, and many of them practicing loving kindness meditation. And he goes there, and he's living in a particular hut in the forest, surrounded by a bit of sort of nice grove of trees. And he's very assiduous in his cultivation of the loving kindness meditations. And he's practices diligently for 4 or 5 months, and then it's this sort of wish comes into his mind, and says, well, maybe I'll go off to some other monastery and practice with such and such a teacher. With that formulation of this wish, then he hears this sobbing outside of his dwelling place. So he goes out And then there's this deity who lives in a sort of big tree nearby. So what's wrong? Well, I've just realized you've just had the thought that you want to leave, and that just makes me sad. And the while you've been here practicing loving kindness, and it's just, you know, I've been happy, and then all of the beings around here will be happy. And if you leave, then all the sort of the other devas and other non-human beings are just going to keep on go back to arguing and quarreling like they used to do. Says, while you've been here practicing, and it's just everything's been peaceful. And so he said, well, okay, well, I'll stay for longer. He didn't want to upset them, so he continues with his practice. And of course, in good Buddhist fashion, it happens three times. And finally, he gives up his determination to go anywhere and stays there and attains enlightenment, which is always what happens in stories. And you know, one can think, well, there's these sort of shaggy dog stories in from the scriptures and the commentaries, but I know of a monk who something very similar happened to him, where he went. He's a monk who really embodies loving kindness. His name is, he's still living, Ajahn Gunha, and he's actually a nephew of Ajahn Chah, now he's well into his 60s, but when he was a younger monk, he has a major realizations when he was a young monk. He practiced very diligently, and that quality of loving kindness is a predominant feature of his being. And he was one time he was traveling by himself. This was before he even established a monastery or a regular monastery. And this was along the border of Burma, and it's an area of big expanses of jungle, but it was also an area in that time where there was a lot of insurgents living, and anyway, he was walking through the jungle and he walked into this large encampment of communist insurgents, and they immediately sort of surrounded him with weapons and asked him, you know, tried to question him, grill him, how did he get in? They thought he was a government spy, because he was able to, because the whole area was mined around their encampment, so he'd been able to walk through a minefield. And they held him there for, I can't remember how long it was, quite some time, and continued to question him, but they warmed up to him, and certainly looked after him in terms of feeding him and that. And then after some time, then they were convinced of that. Yeah, this is a genuine monk. He's not not. We should let him go, and so they accompanied him and took him out through the minefields and sent him on his way. Then they came back And they, and then that was that sort of realization. Why did we let him go? It was so nice having a monk here. It's like everybody was living harmoniously and happy. And he was such a wonderful presence for us. And so they tromped out after him. Invited him, please come back and stay with us. And we'll look after you for the rains retreat. And he said, oh, sorry, I've already made a commitment to spend the rains in such and such a place. I really appreciate your offer. But that was that sort of feeling. Oh, wow. Yeah, when he was here, everything was felt good. So that that presence of loving kindness. Okay, let's take some time to just sit and then use these phrases, this particular structure. Establishing a ease in the posture, an alertness, comfort, allowing the breathing to be very natural, easeful, relaxing any kind of tension, allowing the breath to come in very, very clearly, without any obstruction, allowing the breath to go out without any obstruction, not controlling, just feeling very comfortable and at ease. And then as one physically feels at ease, attention and mindfulness are present, then to formulate that wish, may I abide in well-being. Allowing the breath to come in, the breath to go out, allowing the heart to resonate around that very sincere wish. May I abide in well-being. May I abide in happiness. May I abide in freedom from affliction. Just to allow that to resonate through the body and the mind. May I abide in freedom from suffering, discomfort, mental, physical, any kind of dukkha. Just to establish that wish toward oneself, that sense of cherishing oneself with that sincere wish. Freedom from anything that's afflicting, obstructing. Allowing that wish to be an energy within the body and within the mind. Allow that energy to flow through the whole body, permeating the whole body, the whole mind. That sincere wish for happiness, freedom from suffering. May I abide in freedom from hostility. Allow allowing the mind to relinquish and release any kind of hostile intention, aversive intention, negative intention toward oneself, towards others. Because the first person who is harmed when we formulate a intention of hostility or aversion is ourselves. We're the first person to feel it. We're the first person to experience that. And it is painful. Being able to release and relinquish with that very clear intention or that clear wish, may I abide in freedom from hostility. May I abide in freedom from ill will. Again, not setting up any kind of contention, conflict, putting it all down and directing that wish and feeling and aspiration for well-being toward oneself. May I abide in freedom from anxiety. Recognizing the inevitable tendency toward fear, worry, concern, anxious wondering, but setting that intention, setting that wish, may I abide in freedom from any kind of anxiety. And recognizing, yeah, it'd be a very different world to approach one's own perception of oneself and the world around one if there were freedom from that anxiety, fear. May I maintain well-being in myself. Start returning to the wish, aspiration for a stability of well-being, a steadiness of that sense of happiness that comes when the mind is not overwhelmed by negative habits of mind. And recognizing that it's actually possible. It's a very noble aspiration to set for oneself. It's the holding oneself dear, cherishing oneself in an appropriate way. So allowing these aspirations, recollections to permeate, pervade the body and the mind, this well-wishing, this loving kindness, this friendliness. As that is increasingly well established, feel stable, to allow the focus to be broader, expanding the focus so that it encompasses all around, inclusive of others. And may all beings abide in well-being. May everyone abide in well-being. May everyone abide in freedom from hostility. Yeah, we can't force the world and all beings to live that way, but we can have the aspiration. We can have that wish. We can perceive the benefit. And to hold that within the heart. May everyone abide in freedom from ill will. Now we see the suffering and pain that arises from that. And to have that very sincere wish of concern, of compassion, of friendliness, of care, wishing for all beings, may everyone abide in freedom from ill will. Allowing the heart to be open and expansive. May everyone abide in freedom from anxiety. That wishing of safety and security. Beings, may everyone maintain well-being in themselves. As we're able to establish that intention without division within the mind, not separating anybody out into us and them, my group and that group, just that expansive wish, expansive aspiration. That everyone is able to maintain well-being in themselves. Allows the mind to break down the barriers of how we habitually compare, divide, and suffer because of it. These cultivations of these phrases and tuning into the feelings that they generate are both helpful for that cultivation of a feeling, a mood of loving kindness. But it also gives us an insight into the way the mind works, how we cherish ourselves or overlook ourselves, how we look to others, how we compare, how we judge. And in the loving kindness meditations, there's no judging, there's no comparing. Just allowing the heart to abide in kindness, in well-being. We can just take this time to sit for a bit longer and then I'll